This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Police murders must stop now. Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Eddie Gray, Rakia Boyd, Andy Lopez, Tamir Rice, one after the other, and so many others, precious black and brown lives, victims of police murder. We think of their faces and furiously ache for justice. Over 1,000 people a year killed by police. Yet since 2005, less than 60 indictments, less than 25 convictions. Millions languish in prisons, generations after generation. Black and Latino brothers and sisters, the spearhead of a whole matrix of oppression. The people have struggled, resisted, risen up, and Building Bridges straight from the line of march with them lifts up the voices of the family members from across the country who have lost their beloved at the hands of the police, along with a growing number of their supporters who tell us what we must do to go further. In so many ways, we must intensify our struggle. We now join Mimi Rosenberg on the line of march.
Next, we will hear from the son of St. Q.
St. Q is my son's name. I want you to remember the name. St. Q. We call him Q. This young man's spirit was connected to mine even before he was born. And I trust me, he is here. St. Q was gunned down, I say executed, in Jackson, Tennessee, just 3 months after Mike Brown. Lying on the ground, face down, shot in the back. St. Q posed so little threat, these cops actually went back to the car and then came back and shot him in the back. Now you can see the shot, the execution on video. But even to this day, they are in denial. They have even lied about the cop that actually fired the shot. This is how layered the conspiracy is, the cover-up. I'm glad to be a part of this justice train. I came all the way here. I'll go anywhere to stand with any family, but bring this justice train through the plantation in Jackson, Tennessee. Those of you who can, November 6th is the one-year anniversary. We got to take this train all around the country, but come to the plantation because we need you there, brothers. It's as bad as it was in the 50s and the 60s.
This is my daughter, Adesha Miller. 24 years, 364 days. That's exactly how long my daughter lived. But I can tell you another number. 1,204. That's how many days she's been gone. Some of these people getting these badges, you were hired to do a job, to uphold a law, to serve and protect. And if you can't do it, you need not be in that position. All of these so-called prosecutors who don't have the guts, the heart to convince these people for what they are doing need to get their asses out of office too. I'm here from Detroit, and my prosecutor is Kim Worthless. Her last name is Worthy, but she ain't even worthy of me mentioning. No investigation into my daughter's death, though she was shot at a police officer's house, at his party, with his service weapon. And they waited 25 minutes to call 911. They never checked him for any alcohol or drugs. They stopped short of saying my daughter shot herself. Though she has no gunshot residue on her hands, her clothes, she was shot in her lung, and it went through her heart. I don't think her going out that night to celebrate her upcoming birthday was her plan to end up dead. The last thing I told her was that I loved her. And I thank God that I got to hear her say, I love you back. Because I got to remember that for the rest of my life.
Our next speaker is Sheila Reed. Power to the people. My son Jerome Reed was killed in Bridgeton, New Jersey. His hands was up. They did a stop because they didn't do a full stop at the stop sign. His friend had a Jaguar. In the Jaguar was a gun in the glove compartment. But the gun did not belong to my son. The police officer, Dave, intercepted the gun out the glove compartment and held it and had his gun drawn out of his case. He shot my son 7 times. They murdered my son. My son has a baby boy that turned 1 year old last week. He was 3 months old when his father got killed. My son is not here to celebrate his son's birthday. I want the police officer arrested and let them know what it feels like to be locked up. My son got locked up. They beat him so bad, they jumped him in jail. They beat his eye socket out, broke his ribs, maced him, and left him for dead in the jail for 2 or 3 hours. I want these officers arrested. All the officers that's murdering our children, our husbands, our sons, I want them arrested. We pay their taxes to take care of us, not to kill us. And that's what they're doing. They're taking it right back to slavery time. We need to do something. We need to stand up. Stand up and fight. Power to the people.
All power to the people. All power to the people.
I am with two folks who have come from Brooklyn, mobilizing through a faith-based organization.
My name is Dr. Jamila Lipscott. We come here together from the King's Church of Christ. We're a community organizing collective in East Flatbush. It's very important to think about the role of the faith community to take a stand and to be a part of a movement that brings people together and think about what kind of world we want to see.
Do you have any sentiments around where we are, around the issue of police violence, the nature of racism within our society that is the fuel for the policing apparatus to use to kill, to torture people of color?
We're in a sad place when in our institutional spaces there's not a concrete way for us to deal with something as fundamental as the disposability of black bodies. This is a big glaring issue with statistical significance, and on a fundamental level we can't acknowledge that this exists and that there needs to be a change.
Well, I see another friend of yours, Jerome. So I know that you're an educator with young people in Brownsville in East New York, Brooklyn.
I'm a big believer in movements. I studied the civil rights movement. I believe that nothing ever changes without people rising up and letting their voices be heard. Movements like this, when you get a lot of people out, it raises attention to the matter. A lot of these things are not going to be changed until we make some serious policy changes. We have individuals who are in office who this doesn't affect, because it happens in Brownsville. It happens in Houston, where I grew up at. But it's not affecting them in their neighborhoods where they are, so they don't feel the urgency that we do, where our young black people are losing their lives simply for being who they are.
Hopefully it develops into a mass movement, but we have Black Lives Matter, which still looks a little bit like a hashtag. Many of us experience these mass rallies. What do we do that's going to create a sustainable process to alter the power paradigms and the prevalence of racism?
As an educator, I think it starts with our kids. We need to start having real conversations with them about racism. I tell my students all the time that you all are the leaders of tomorrow. Once you rise up, you have to go back to your community and do the work of improvement. There's a lack of culturally relevant teaching present in our school system today. Our kids, they shouldn't be learning about Columbus Day. They should be learning about Indigenous Peoples Day. Why aren't they learning more about Dr. George Washington Carver or the IBM computer engineer who has nearly 100 patents? Why are they learning about these types of individuals? And then once we build up the pride within our students, and not only do we build up the pride, we actually teach them, because that's a big problem. And District 23, where I teach in Brownsville, it's the worst district in the city of New York. And until we fix that, that's another way we're disclosing black bodies, because we're not educating our kids and preparing them to be leaders. So until we change that, and until we can address these issues of police brutality, it's not going to get better.
I don't want us to underestimate the power of what it means for everybody to come here. They come together as a collective in this moment, but are a part of sustainable efforts, consistently disrupting the spaces that they engage in on the daily. I push back against the idea that Black Lives Matter and other movements are in some something shaky or not sustainable, because what they do is they open a conversation so that on Columbia University's campus, consistently we've been having a conversation about Black Lives Matter. We couldn't say that 5 years ago. People are angry. The wound is revealed and it's festering and we're dealing with it, even if it's not a concrete program. As a country, we are being forced to face these questions. And because I'm an educator, I definitely care and believe in the power of educating our young people. It's changing them from people who feel like they just go to school to learn and just to become somebody's employee, and instead helping them to see that they're active transformers of our world. That's powerful work. So I don't want us to think about this social media platform that we have. It's a powerful virtual space that is bringing together and pushing a conversation that we have not had in this country in decades.
I agree. No longer does the fourth estate have realm over what the discourse in public is. You have literally millions of people who are having this discourse over Facebook, over Twitter. You can't silence a million people's voices. Race and class, these issues, it's not supposed to be an easy conversation. But now, our dirty laundry is starting back to air itself. So we have to face these issues head on, and until we do, we're going to continue to see more police brutality. We're going to see oppressed people in this country continue to be oppressed. So we need to have these conversations. This discourse is important. And not only is it important in the academic spaces, it needs to happen in church. It needs to happen at home. It needs to happen at work. We can't sweep our issues under the rug any longer, because it's going to eventually self-destruct our nation. We have so much talent that's being wasted in our neighborhoods. This Black Lives Matter movement, it isn't just about police brutality. More like that. We need to be educated. We need health care. We need fair housing. It's so much bigger than that.
So when we say we matter, and when we say that this is injustice, we're saying that this is not just an attack on a physical body, but on our spiritual selves. And if you ask anybody here, I guarantee you that the people who leave here, they go back to organizations and they go back to spaces where they're thinking about how is this happening respectively in our local spaces of influence. And that's the power of a movement like this.
Thank you both for being here, for the organizing that you engage, and for your sentiments which you're sharing with us. I'm here in front of a very impressive sign, Black women are killed by the police. Say their names. You are?
Brittany Hazelwood. I'm the communications coordinator for the African American Policy Forum. Came up with the hashtag Say Her Name to uplift the names of women and girls of color who have been victims of police brutality. Names that we don't often hear. Professor Crenshaw.
Kimberly Crenshaw.
Who's the director of the African American Policy Forum. She actually recently did an exercise at the Rise Up October event at Columbia University, where she asked everyone in the audience to raise their hand when they knew certain names. And she asked everyone to raise their names when they heard the name Eric Gardner, if they knew that name, or raise their hands when they heard the name Freddie Gazzari. And it was remarkable to see when she asked the names of Natasha McKenna, when we asked the names of Rakia Boyd, when we asked the names of Ayanna Stanley Jones, that the hands were remarkably different. So we're really here to uplift the names that sometimes are always on the margin, to put a gender lens on the racial equality movement, and give a face to the names that are often and too often aren't uplifted. And that you can't have a holistic racial equality movement without an intersectional lens. And that includes Black women and girls, women of color and girls, trans lives, and includes everyone who's on the margins. Handicapped includes everybody. I'll lift up one name, that's Natasha McKenna. Just recently, the police department in Fairfax County released a video of her showing her naked body being tased 4 times. She ultimately died from those taser shots. And it's a video that most people haven't seen. So I would say a little piece of advice is just to know these names, to speak these names. And when you go to an event, every time you say a name of a man or a boy, also say a name of a woman or a girl, because there's just as many women's names that deserve to be uplifted as well.
Thank you very much for speaking to us. And now I'm going to move to the person who's holding up the other half of the sign.
My name is Lauren Broussard. I'm a first-year doctoral student at Columbia School of Public Health. Gender doesn't protect Black people from state-sponsored violence. These women, the loss of their lives is just as painful. Their families are struggling to cope with that. We need to make sure that their faces and their names are known. We need to understand the way that racism and misogyny can combine to cut people's lives short. It's as if we talk about each issue separately, not realizing how they come together and really have a dual impact on women of color, Black women, Asian women, Latino women, Native women, you know, women coming to the United States from other countries. We also need to talk about the sexual violence that's perpetrated upon these women. So we lift these names up. These are the names that we know. We know that there are names that we'll never know, and we want to stop adding more names to the list by creating awareness.
Do you have a sense that there will be the kind of organization that perhaps was more prevalent in the 60s, so this habitual problem is dealt with in a more consistent and less reactive basis?
Sure. We need system-level changes. I do have optimism. You look at the beautiful diversity in this crowd out here today. We got a long way to go, but at least we're walking. At least we're on the journey. And I'll take it. And it's hard not to be discouraged, heartbroken, but the work must be done.
The sisters in the school system, do you find that these issues resonate with them such that they really can commit to bring more people to this process?
I have to respect all the ways that people participate in the movement. Social media absolutely matters to this effort, and if that's what some people can offer, what they can bring, then we'll absolutely take it. It's important to engage people at all different sorts of levels so that they can see themselves participating. They can feel a connection. Surely there are people who feel angry at the loss of these lives but aren't sure what to do. And sometimes the best thing you can do is talk to your friends, talk to your family. You know, holiday season is coming up. Don't be quiet at the Thanksgiving table. You know, speak truth to power.
It's very energizing to speak with you. Thank you for raising up the names that are too often lost in the process of our tears for the brothers that have indeed been killed. Thank you.
Thank you.
You have a sign with the name of Maya Hall. It says, "Remember when a trans woman of color from Baltimore was killed by police?" Talk about why you think that is so important to lift up. And by the way, who are you?
Morgan Miller. Women of color are some of the most marginalized individuals in this country, and specifically within the context of this movement against police brutality, transgender women of color are left out of the conversation. Very rarely can we point to a moment where the country has rallied behind a woman, much less a transgender woman. It's important to include them in the conversation because they are being affected by this equally, if not more. She was misgendered after the report of when she was shot. She was shot in Baltimore. You know, you had the uprising for Freddie Gray, but it was mum's word when it came to Maya Hall. No, most people probably don't even know who she is. This just happened this year in April. So it's important that in the context of ending police brutality and this genocide against black people in this country, that we are talking about all black people, not just black men, not just black women, not just cis people, but also trans people, because they are equally being affected.
Tell us more about Maya Hall.
She was driving on a parkway. I believe it was the entrance to the NSA. The police claimed that she was bulldozing, and they thought that she was just going through the gate. They just shot several rounds. She was unarmed in the car. When they were giving the description, she was frequently misgendered as two cross-gender people. She was with another person, one of her friends. It was a man in drag. And so not only is there hate for black people, there's hate for trans people. There's hate for women. And so that's pretty much the reason why I decided to carry this particular sign, because who is being left out of the conversation in the context of this movement against police brutality? Black women, but also black transgender women.
Thank you for raising up the issue and for being here today.
Justice! Now! Shut it down! Shut it down! Shut it down!
I can't breathe! I can't breathe! I can't breathe!
You're holding up a huge sign. You're going to tell us whose portrait that is, and a banner that says, well, you tell me, it says mass
Action Against Police Brutality, grassroots anti-police brutality group from Roxbury, Massachusetts.
Oh, you came all the way from, okay.
We're just here in support of the march. You know, we think there needs to be a mass movement in this country to fight against police brutality and mass incarceration. The government's proven that it's unwilling to do the right thing. We need to organize massive public political pressure. We can't rely on politicians. We can't rely on the government to do the right thing. So we have to step up. We can't expect anything to change unless we get involved. Marches are important. Some people think they haven't produced anything. Now it's passe, but we don't even really think we've even started marching yet. What we've seen in the last year is promising, is inspiring, because it woke people up. But the work has only just begun, so we're not discouraged, but we're determined to reach out deeper into the community and the society at large to get the millions of people involved that have to be involved in the street and not just watching from the sidelines or from the living rooms. You know.
Who's the portrait of that you are carrying on the sandwich board?
This is a portrait of Tamir Rice. We just wanted to highlight his case because it's going to be a year of his murder. It's one of the most well-known cases in this modern era of police brutality and of collusion of the government to try to exonerate these cops, video evidence. Family needs the support. We need to mobilize public political pressure.
And of course, Tamir Rice was the 12-year-old youth shot at point-blank range instantaneously upon their arrival at the venue where there was a report of a possible gun incident. And we're building support. What else do you think we need to do to really create the kind of sustained movement, not merely a presence, when the next catastrophe occurs?
It starts with reaching out directly to the community. We're going door to door in the neighborhood. Every time anything happens, and it doesn't have to just be a murder, just a case of brutality, but as a survivor, we try to organize opposition to it immediately and raise more public and political pressure around it. We can't really do much more than that until we build the numbers. You know, once we have numbers, then we can talk about some other things. But until we got the numbers, no small group is going to substitute the power of millions. Despite all the protests people have seen, and they've been remarkable, the spontaneity of it, a lot of it's really just been organized online. And very little outreach has really happened in the neighborhoods. A lot of people tell me that nobody's reached out to them. They didn't know where the meeting was, and even know when the demonstration was. But there's a deep well of opposition in the country that's yet untapped and will boil over again. We've only seen the spontaneous aspect of it, but the new groups have formed, and you know, more sustained action has been launched, you know, and I believe that's going to show itself over time. But consistent, systematic outreach to the people who are being affected by this daily. And that's really the fuel, is because it's happening daily, and it's happening all over the country. And I just think the other thing that's been revealed is that a new leadership has to be built in this country, that the old guard has kind of been rejected. A new generation stepped into the vacuum, but still people have to learn lessons how to wage an effective struggle. And that's being worked out through trial and error. And I don't think it's been solved yet, but I think we're solving it in struggle.
Where does your consciousness come from? Consciousness that goes into organizing?
I'm not a millennial. I'm more of like a Generation X. But I would say one thing about this era is it not only has awakened a whole new generation, but it's breathed life in some of the old guard that maybe fought the good fight and got discouraged. That's what it meant for me. Like, now we can finally actually wage the type of fight I've been trying to do for decades. People are more receptive to the need to organize independently of the mainstream parties and to organize in the streets. That's become a thing that more people are open to now. It's a breath of fresh air. It's what's been needed. And it's the only possibility of solving these problems. So I'm encouraged. I'm optimistic. People are waking up. My name is Brock Satter. I'm with Mass Action Against Police Brutality. We're in Boston, Massachusetts, Roxbury.
Thanks very much for speaking with us. Welcome to New York.
Thank you.
Now I'm in the struggle and I can't breathe. about the race and police, and we ain't gonna stop till people are free.
Excuse me, do you have a poster that talks about Akai Gurley? Do you want to tell us who you are and why you're here today?
I'm Kevin Foster Palmer, and I'm here to support the black community against police violence.
How old are you?
13.
At 13, why do you have the consciousness and sensitivity? Why did you think it was important to be here?
Growing up as a young African-American man, I want to be safe talking to the police and going up to the police. I don't want to be scared to go up to them and stuff like that.
What neighborhood do you live in?
Montclair, New Jersey.
Have you actually or your friends had experiences that are negative with the police?
I've had a friend who was slammed by the police once because he wasn't supposed to be at the library, and then they called him, and they asked him to leave, so he was leaving. But then the police grabbed his arm and said he was going to arrest him, so the kid tried to run, and he picked him up and slammed him. I don't understand it. I don't know why it has to be towards a young African-American man, but if it was a young white boy, they would treat him differently. It doesn't make sense to me.
What is your experience and your intellect tell you that says that there is a difference in treatment between white and black youth?
I've seen it with my own eyes. I've seen police talk to white kids normally for doing something that we would get yelled at and almost arrested for. Most of my friends are scared to talk to police, or if the police come around, they become really uncomfortable with them because they don't want to get hurt or go to jail for something that's so minor.
You're a very impressive young man, and you were wearing a Can't Breathe t-shirt carrying a Stop the War on Black America. Are you glad you're here today?
Yeah, I am.
Well, thank you for speaking with us.
Okay, we got Marcus Pettiford on behalf of Anthony Anderson. Marcus Pettiford and Nicole Pettiford.
Back in 2012, my father was murdered by the Baltimore City Police Department. He was slammed on the back of his head. He suffered a ruptured spleen as well as 6 broken ribs. The coroner ruled it a homicide. Greg Bernstein was in office at the time. He decided not to prosecute his officers. He laughed in my family's face in a secret meeting that we had with him. They said, oh, I'm not prosecuting my officers. They acted within the guidelines of their jobs. I want to thank you for being one voice, one community, and let them know that we are here now. You can no longer sweep this under the rug. I'm coming here all the way from Baltimore City. One community, one voice. No justice, no peace.
Next, we will hear from Nicole Pepperford.
I came up with a song, and it's perfect for this. Don't tell me it's over now. Please don't tell me it's over now. I said my father's got it, and it's all planned out. I tell you God's got it, and it's all planned out. So don't you worry, it's all planned out. I want y'all to remember that. It is all planned out. They're not going to stop us, and we will be heard. We are one family, no matter what color, no matter where you came from. Every life matters.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.